Hey everybody, and welcome to episode 102 of the Great Linear Song of Ice and Fire reread, brought to you by Vassals of Kingsgrave. My name is Bina 007, I'll be your host today, and we may potentially spoil anything in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. If we spoil TWoW stuff, which may well happen, we'll do that clearly marked in the after show, but we won't spoil Game of Thrones. Today I'm joined, after a long hiatus, by SJ Lee. Hey Stephen.
Hi, this is Stephen in real life, SJ Lee on the forums.
Proving that there's no such thing as a free supper with me.
Correct. Price, debts must be paid.
Debts must be paid in the form of chocolate cake. That chocolate cake in Toronto is insane.
That's taller than my baby is.
It's not bad.
Yeah, I would encourage anyone who goes to Toronto to try and eat King's cake because it's basically insane. We're also joined by Blue Armor on the forums.
Hey, it's one of the Mats.
One of the Mats. And also by the other of the Mats, Vali.
The other Mat.
How are you feeling, Vali?
I feel like hell.
Oh, no. And by Michael.
Hey, Carl Wadeggi on the forums.
So this is a small and beautifully formed podcast. We had a couple of dropouts from the girls, so it's the kind of inverse of Charlie's Angels, Bina's Hellions, or whatever you want to call that.
Bina's Chaps.
Okay, cool. So in the last episode, we covered the Battle of Marines. So it was all TWoW chapters, took place on July 18th, or at least the start of the Battle of Marine. We're now jumping to events in August 300 AL. Before we do, here's our usual typical bonkers summary of July 300 in the world of George R. R. Martin. He spent 18 chapters in July 300. Which speaks to his slow progress. In this month, in the world of Ice and Fire, Cersei was put on trial and did her walk of shame. Arianne arrived at Griffin's Roost and learned that Storm's End had fallen. Stannis started marching for Winterfell. Meanwhile, in Essos, Dany flew away on Drogon. Quentin was alive. Barristan staged a coup against Hisdar and the Battle of Meereen began. This time a year ago, just a year ago in July 299, George covered the events in just 5 chapters, which I think speeds to his slowing down to an absolute halt, in A Clash of Kings. Marcella was sent to Dawn, John was at the Fist of First Men, Theon took Winterfell. That'll be poignant, I guess, in these chapters. And we were vocking this stuff in episodes 325 and 332 in September 2016, at which point Bina was still single. I hadn't actually met my husband at that point. Matt hadn't got married or had a baby.
So we've been more productive than George.
We've been, but not very productive.
Been reproductive.
We've been reproductive. You've been reproductive, at least. When you hear the quants, the hard stats, does it surprise you at, or is this to be expected, that where you used to cover a month and 5 chapters, you're now down to 18? And how do you feel about this, boys?
Some events need detail. They need that detail, and we obviously have more characters. That's all I'm going to say.
He tried to defend it. He really did.
He did.
I agree that some chapters need more details, but I think the majority of the chapters that are taking place are kind of the travelogue chapters that we complain about generally in A Dance with Dragons.
I think there is a part of it where the story is snowballing, but the events are snowballing. Like, things are just becoming more complicated and growing in complexity as the story advances. You know, you have, Balon dies rather suddenly, and that, like, triggers the Game of Thrones and the Iron Islands and, like, a variety of political fallout there, which George goes and explores, which is not strictly necessary, but I think it's the idea of that, essentially dominoes are falling and hitting other things and causing other things to ripple out and complicating the story in so many different ways than it was initially. I think it's especially notable when you look at these chapters and how the North is described and contrast that to how the North feels in Game of Thrones. Like, the North is pretty limited in scope and range, and you could just say that's world building, but I think it actually is qualitatively different in significant ways from the first book to the fifth book.
Oh, you're talking about the book, not the TV show?
Yes, I'm talking about the books.
You see, I got the impression reading these chapters again, like, how the North wasn't even really looked into in the TV show. There's so much good shit here that was, like, never addressed that I wonder, like, why that decision was made. But yes, I agree with you about the books as well.
Well, I think it's true of the books. Like, Game of Thrones, the North is a homogenous, unified. The North is one thing, loyal under the Starks, and it's basically Winterfell and its Enverons, right? Like, that's how it very much feels in the first book, and which is what makes the betrayal of the Boltons like the slow reveal through books 2 and 3. But like, there's just a diversity of character and culture that makes it a lot more complicated than you get in the first book. And I think that's just more sand in the gears, right? It's slowing everything down and causing more problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think one way to look at it is when I just wrote down that list of stuff that had happened this month, and you combine Feast and Dance, and you've got Cersei's Walk of Shame, and you've got things with Euron happening, and all the stuff in Essos with the Battle of Meereen, and you just think, it did actually increase my admiration for George, because I thought he has got so many plates spinning, and it's no wonder he's struggling to grapple to bring it all together, because it genuinely is a very daunting task. And I really do wonder if anything this complex has ever been seen before. I mean, it's just stunning in some ways. But yeah, that's all that maybe needs to be said about that, because otherwise it becomes a little bit depressing. Okay, so in this episode, after our Teewell chapters, we return to Dance with a ghost in Winterfell, Theon 6, Theon 1/Theon 7, and the sacrifice, Arsha 2. These chapters take place between August 1st and August 6th, 300 AL. And here's Vali with a chapter summary of A Ghost in Winterfell.
Yeah, you mixed them up in the Google Doc. It's me.
Oh, sorry. It's the wrong Matt. Oh, such an easy mistake to make. Okay, well, with one of the best chapters, I think, in Dance, here is the appropriate Matt.
In the far reaches of the North, the raging fires of war battle with the enveloping cold of winter. Two armies are kept apart by impenetrable snows, and patience is becoming a scarce commodity. As the stronghold of Winterfell is being slowly buried by the never-ending storm, soldiers begin mysteriously dying. Now, a ragtag group of inept lords who trust no one but themselves are forced to work together to find the killer. This is their story. You can just imagine the da-dun. Winterfell, Lord Stark Solar, 5th day of the 8th month, 300 AC, the hour of the wolf. The four lords, Bolton, Dustin, Risewell, and Frey, were in their usual positions around the room. The discussion was no different from the past 3 nights. The arguments were repetitive, the theories were inconclusive, and the case was stuck fast. The latest body had turned up this morning, Yellow Dick, a member of the Ramsay gang. No one would mourn his passing except for Grunt, who is now the unfortunate owner of the stupidest name in the Ramsay gang. However, their leader is offended by all slights, and he now sought vengeance. The uneasy alliance within the stronghold was about to crack. There's no pattern amongst the victims. They were all from different factions, a Risewell, a Flint, a Frey, a Bolton. The killer is not targeting anyone specific. His goal is chaos, and he is succeeding. And it is definitely a he. The victims are large soldiers, and one of them has had his skull crushed in. The serving women do not have the strength, and neither does the most obvious suspect, the Turncloak. Whatever fight he once possessed had been stolen from him by the Ramsay gang. He is merely a shell who has not yet been allowed to die. The clues are few. Swords are missing from the crypts, but have not been used in the killings. The killer is probably an agent of the Lord of Light, but there are no obvious candidates. The only suspect of unknown loyalties is the singer, but he was performing in the dining hall for several of the killings. And then there's this rumor of the hooded man, a shadow in the snow, like there's a fucking faceless man in here. Paranoia's roots have run deep. The investigation is going in circles, and there's just not enough information. The only answer is an infiltrator, known to some, but unknown to us. There are just too many Northern lords unaccounted for. Mormont, Umber, Glovers, Karstark, Reed. The bones of Winterfell are old, and the ghosts whisper loudly. This group of bickering factions is trying to fight the memory of the North itself. And for what? Only the old gods know. It brings to mind a quote from an exiled Bolton whose name has been stricken from all records. Some motherfuckers are always just trying to ice skate uphill. And now the drums of the enemy are beginning to sound like they're coming from inside the stronghold, and time has run out. The challenge must be answered now before the alliance falls apart. The soldiers will have to ride out with a wall of snow in front of them and a ghost at their backs. And that's it, chapter.
Well, I think we have a episode title, Ice Skating Uphill.
Yeah. That's a mix in a Blade quote with a reference to the Boltons being vampires.
Well, it's been a long time since Stephen's been on the podcast, so why don't you start us off with any thoughts you had on this chapter, SJD?
Oh, dear. I didn't expect to go first. I think the first thing that comes to mind is that, like, just how tenuous the alliances are on both sides reading these chapters, and fragile. The tensions inside Winterfell are really interesting. Like, as the chapter progresses, it starts to feel more like a powder keg. Things are going to go wrong inside the walls, even if things go right outside of the walls. Like, there's no way this ad hoc system of alliances can hold out based on the characters that make them up.
Yeah, it's interesting to see, like, Lady Dustin says that great line, the North remembers, to the Lord Hosteen Frey, and, like, they're the inner circle, and even they're duking it out to an extent, and Dustin is obviously not the biggest Stark fan, but yeah, even she is kind of disgusted by the Frey's actions. It's yeah.
Yeah, I think it's pretty pretty interesting that Theon actually recognizes, I think there's a line in the chapter that he's like, no matter what happens, if they go fight Stannis, you know, a foe of Bolton will die, no matter who gets killed. And so it's pretty, like, observant of him to know that even if the guys in the castle die, that's still one less foe the Boltons will have to deal with later.
Yeah, and there's a great theme here emerging as we read these in linear order, which in the last episode in Meereen, or here in Winterfell, or as we then go to Stannis's camp, people trying to hold together uneasy alliances. And as you say, Stephen, you know, there's the enemy outside, but there's also the enemy within, and none of this is sustainable. So the complete breakdown of law and order in the North, and indeed in Meereen, mirrored in a complete lack of authority by the person who is kind of laughably trying to be the titular overlord, either of a region or indeed of the entire country. And just seeing how the different personalities try to deal with that, I think is really fascinating. And I think lots of people, especially when we did the Feast Dance reread before, were commenting on, you know, the parallels between Jon and Dany. But I think it's really interesting to contrast Roose Bolton, Stannis, Barristan, and Jon as well, as people just trying to hold together these really uneasy alliances. I love reading about this stuff.
Yeah, and it kind of brings back, like, to mind, like, Ned to the fore, and kind of, you know, somewhat of a shadow of the Starks that's still kind of looming over the North here. I think it shows maybe some strengths, a real strength of Ned as to how well he was at kind of how good he managed his whatever quote unquote rule of the North. I'm sure he did so by allowing a lot of these people to be more independent, but, you know, he has enough of a legacy and respect that there are very few, you know, lords on either side here that are kind of committed to the, you know, even within the Bolton camp, there he has very few people that are really kind of truly committed to like his side of things, where, you know, everyone seems to be out to like betray him in some sort of manner. There are kind of a lot of like natural disasters and things that go on in Dance with the winter coming on affecting the entire world, and some of them kind of, you know, have annoyed me, where it just seems to be negatively impacting more of the protagonist than the antagonist. But in this case, I like how kind of both sides, you know, who we're rooting for and who we're rooting against, are both kind of negatively impacted equally. And it's, you know, driving them each into, you know, kind of in advantageous positions.
You know what I wonder is, like, when Dustin says the North remembers, does the North remember not to get involved in like a war right before winter comes? Because they're in the current position, like, they have no stores. Like, they're looking to, you know, kind of cull the herd here so a couple can survive. Like, Theon remembers old Nan stories about, you know, winters that last 10 years, snowstorms that last a year or something like that, buried castles. These guys don't even have their shit barely together. What's the end game even if they win here? Like, won't it be easier just to take Winterfell eventually, like, come there in the spring and just, like, kind of walk in?
That's kind of my point I was trying to make. It's kind of laughable hearing these kind of warlords try to make these battle plans, and you think, so what do? You take the castle, how are you going to eat? I mean, it just seems so bizarre to me.
Yeah, I mean, even in my chapter, they say, oh yeah, well, you know, we'll raid the goods of Winterfell, and that's going to be, you know, who cares? Whoever lives and takes Winterfell will have all the spoils of it. It's like, you know, it's almost like the Queen's move, or again, where you know, the spoils are going to be a couple turnips and like a pine cone.
It might be worth considering that the war is not so much an objective, but more of a political piece. Like, without the threat of Stannis, how much worse would the infighting be among these lords? So, like, by constantly presenting as like, yes, we have to go fight Stannis, and he's outside the walls, and that's why we all have to hold together, because he's going to burn us all alive if he gets inside here. Like, is that a political strategy more than a military strategy? I think that might play some element into this.
So they're only fighting Stannis because the Lannisters put the Boltons as wardens of the North to protect it against pretenders like Stannis, right? I don't think it's like some decision that was made by, you know, these individual families. They're just all around the Boltons when they got the orders and had to do it due to loyalty, right?
No, but I'm saying more of, if you say, oh, we're just going to sit together for possibly years until spring comes, that might give them too much room to maneuver, if you see what I'm saying.
I don't know. Like I said, I don't understand their end game. You know, what's the point if the only winner at the end of this is either Roose Bolton the individual or Ramsay Bolton the individual, or maybe both of them, and no one else is there. The Bolton men are done, you know, and everyone else is done.
I think it's something we've seen elsewhere in the story of arguably easy, or it's possible to overthrow a king. But installing someone new to rule is much more complicated. So, like, in an odd way, Bran and Rob, when they were ruling from Winterfell, had a fairly easy time of it because of the institutional, you know, gravity of the Starks in Winterfell. But now that the Boltons are in charge, like, the Boltons are no more special than any of the other major houses in the North. So they can just continue to bicker and fight, and who more deserves to hold power there? Like, it's completely unstable.
They only have the backing of King's Landing at this point, and that's really quite worthless because King's Landing isn't sending them food or soldiers.
Right. Even if the Lannister said, we'll send you 10,000 soldiers, like, okay, have fun marching through winter in the North.
I mean, like, in terms of, yeah, the marching and supplies and all that, like, I mean, as soon as Stannis landed at the wall, like, there was no way he could stay there. He didn't have enough, like, food to just sit an army there for however long it would take for winter to go through. So he had to march, and then in response, you know, the Boltons and their forces, like, all have to gather to meet that response. So, I mean, there's no real other way around it as soon as Stannis decided to land in the North.
Yeah, there's a certain grim inevitability about it, isn't it? You know, once the die of war is cast, it all the responses take place in a sort of fairly logical manner.
Yeah,
and I think even in a previous chapter, it's kind of like keep your friends close and your enemies closer. So the Boltons call everyone to Winterfell, like everyone has to come, or else, you know, they might join in with Stannis or something.
It may be that all these this force was hoping to deal with Stannis before winter sets in, because technically it is still autumn, and this is like no one was really expecting the snowstorm to really seal them in.
It's autumn's kiss. That winter's fucking you. I love Big Bucket Wall.
Fucks you raw.
That's the bumper.
Right there. Oh, dear. Any more on the chapter? Maybe on Theon's state of mind at this point, because that's obviously a big theme of this, the next chapter, and then the one in the next episode from T-Wow.
So, I read these chapters last night in, like, a fever dream of antihistamine and whiskey and stuff, but is this where he ends in the Godswood and he hears the tree call his name and sees Bran's face in the tree?
Yes.
I'm looking at the relevant passage here. It was, the night was windless, the snow drifting straight down out of the cold black sky. Yet the leaves of the heart tree were wrestling his name. Theon, they seem to whisper, Theon. And then Theon's following paragraph, is something I think that's pretty touching, and I think is obviously core to his character. The old gods, he thought, they know me. They know my name. I was Theon of House Greyjoy. I was a ward of Eddard Stark, a friend and brother to his children.
Yeah, if you really believe this is Bran reaching out to him via the Weirnet, then there's something beautifully forgiving and redemptive about this, I feel. And yes, I do think these Theon chapters are incredibly powerful.
I don't understand some of the symbolism, I guess. Maybe not, or not yet. Like, it seemed poignant that the weirwood trees are shaped like little red hands, and I'm not sure why. But like one falls in front of Theon and lands in like one of the pools or whatever. And it makes direct mention that it looks like a red five-fingered hand. And I don't know if that's foreshadowing something or what. Considering, you know, Theon was just made to show his hands that do not have five fingers on them.
And they're not bloody hands, I thought.
Well, not anymore.
I mean, to me, it was just a moment of Bran reaching out, essentially, like, kind of like trying to like lift his face up or something like that. You know, how you would have someone like bow before you asking for forgiveness, and you kind of like lift their head up instead.
I think it actually kind of robs the scene of a nice moment if it is Bran. Like, to me, this is much more revealing of like Theon connecting to something that's important to him than if it's like Bran is using old god magic to talk to Theon. Like, no, I'd much rather this be an internal thing occurring with Theon. But,
right, but it's both. Like, it's both.
Yeah, it can be both at the same time.
Okay, fair. But I hope it's just not interpreted as, Bran did this. Like, if it's ever revealed, this is what Bran is up to, rather than, like, Theon's struggle with his own identity.
There's the literal way to interpret this in the figurative, symbolic way. Yeah, they're not the same.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling when Bran's reveal is finally revealed, he's going to be in charge of a lot of shit, and we're going to be like, what the fuck?
I mean, I certainly feel like, I mean, it happens, you know, in this chapter, and I think it happens in the Wind's, like, preview chapter, too. Like, it seems like Bran is pushing, you know, is nudging Theon in a certain direction, but, like, it's still, I don't know, it doesn't take it away from me. Like, it still feels like Theon is making a journey on his own accord. I mean, the Theon's storyline has always been my favorite part of Dance, and I don't think it's particularly close.
Really?
And these chapters are wonderful. I mean, just like the kind of the final like part of the journey here, where we have him asking for forgiveness, him taking a leap of faith, and then appearing before Asha, unrecognizable, but you know, with one of the better final lines of the novel of, you know, you always must remember your name.
Right.
Like, I love this overall set of chapters.
I agree. I think they're so powerful, so beautiful. And partly because they do work on both levels, that you have this beautiful character study that's very realistic and psychological about a man coming to terms with his past and having been hugely abused and his identity, but also because it links into the huge mythos of this series and whatever Bran is up to. And I think it can be both, and it's richer for being both. And I think these novels are at their best when things work on both levels. And yeah, it's just beautiful to me.
With the description of this chapter, like, I find it really almost claustrophobic at points, where they're describing like the snow building up on the crenellations and like piling up on the stables that are collapsing. But it feels like almost you could breathe again when you get to the Godswood, where like the snow still is melting on the warm waters of the pools and stuff like that. Did anyone else get like this feeling, like, not only that, you know, we've been getting it throughout the books that winter is coming, and like winter's a big character in the book, regardless of, you know, the chapter POV.
Yeah, this is one of the chapters where George's skill as a horror writer, not that this is exactly horror, but there is some otherworldly presence from the snow and the way it's affecting the psyches of all these various people. That, yeah, you can feel the tensity in the air.
Yeah, it's very atmospheric, and yeah, you're right, Varley, with the Godswood is very obviously a symbol of kind of respite. Whereas, you know, kind of the rest of Winterfell, they literally have to dig pathways just to get from like one area of Winterfell to the other, amidst the snow and then the drums that come in the end with the boom and doom and all that stuff is wonderful, particularly fun end to the chapter.
Oh yeah, them ending with the drums and then, you know, the whisper everyone, you know, Stannis. I think it almost plays on like a Lovecraftian kind of thing that George loves, is like, you know, that unknowable, you know, pending doom, that undescribable anxiety that's coming through something just from a horn blowing and drums beating.
Yeah, it's very analogous to the Red Wedding, that you know something is off, something weird is going on. And it is a trick, just as at the Red Wedding, the band are a trick. Who is making this noise outside of the castle, who's doing the drumming, is a trick. And there's beautiful analogies in this chapter, I feel.
And they all think it's Stannis who, you know, moments ago they were all downplaying, like, oh, he'll freeze out in the woods, it's no big deal. Like, and then all of a sudden he's at his front door. Mm-hmm. Now whether he actually is or not.
And I think these chapters make good use of Winterfell as a setting, because if I remember correctly, Winterfell is one of the biggest castles in the book. Like, it's a giant sprawling space. So there's like a lot of unwatched areas, a lot of hidden corners that things can be happening that the people in charge can't know about. You know, lots of room for...
I think just the Godswood in Winterfell is something like 10 acres or something insane like that.
Yeah, it's really, really big. So, like, there's obviously the claustrophobic aspect of where they're all trapped in there together, but at the same time, no one can tell what everyone is up to at the same time. You know, you see two people walk into a room, what have they been talking about? Or why are they talking together? You know, I'm sure the paranoia is getting pretty high among the collection of lords there.
You guys ever see the Twilight Zone where two guys are stuck in a train station and, you know, they hear over the radio that there's a killer on the loose and both of them just are stuck because it's snowing outside, it's bad weather or whatever. And they're just, they go mad and they just think the other one is a killer, like, and so the paranoia just builds and builds and builds. I feel like something similar to that happened.
Any theories on who the hooded man is that confronts Theon in this chapter?
Or not, so just like a representation, the theory is that he's Blackfish, or... right?
There are, the full research into this is, like, there are multiple possibilities. And it's basically just like, right, there's not enough information to go on, and I feel like it can be any number of kind of like missing, like, northern / like Stark loyalists, because you have people like, you have Blackfish, you have Harwin, you have Hal Mullen, who was with Ned's Bones. You have all the people who were, like, you know, traveling to Greywater Watch, like, you know, Mage Mormont and Galbert Glover. Robert Glover is missing. It could simply just be more like crow food sneaking in at night. There's even like an out there thing for, you know, Harry and Carr Stark. So it's kind of a whole bunch of things where, you know, it's some like Stark loyalist. At least I'm not of the, like, you know, Theon Durden theory. I don't like that. That seems silly to me.
Was that?
It's a play on Tyler Durden of Fight Club. Like, they just think it's an alternate personality of Theon who's been doing the killings, but that just seems stupid and silly.
Is that like a Preston Jacobs bullshit thing?
I don't think, no. I mean, it can be anyone's. We've had how many years? 10 years to do this? It was bound to come up. I really do like the interaction he has, like, with that hooded man who just, like, his response to that, I think, was some perhaps interesting foreshadowing with how Roose or Ramsay's fate will end and how Theon will play a part in that. Where he's just like, you know, Ramsay's not done with me yet. The gods are not done with me yet. So it kind of like offers a foreshadowing opportunity of him to redeem himself a little bit before he goes out.
Do you think that it might, like, even show, like, you know, the lower, you know, man-at-arms kind of position of how do they view Theon? Because, you know, Theon marched with the Northerners, you know, up until, after Whispering Wood, he left for the Iron Islands. So there could be just a regular dude that just, like, knew Theon was there, saw him, and kind of recognizes him now and talks to him and just says, you know... Like, that's how deeply their loyalty goes, that even though he's made it through all these wars and he's just walking the, you know, the watch that night, he still sees Theon and recognizes him and feels, like, aggression towards him.
Yeah, he's the embodiment of just the North.
Yeah, he's just like, what the fuck? Like, how are you still around?
And you see it with, like, some of the guards as they let him into the various halls. Like, they sneer at him, they spit at him, like, yeah. People fucking hate Theon.
But how many of them actually know he is Theon and not just Reek?
The fact
that's
that
a really good question.
Theon is dressed up to present fake Arya and sort of...
Okay, so after the wedding, it kind of tipped the hand there?
I would say like everyone would know, because like, you know, you'd point and say, hey, that look, that used to be Theon, look what he is now, and all that stuff. So I don't know if there was any, necessarily a mystery as to who he is.
Because, you know, for the first chapter of this book called Reek, I don't think I realized it was Theon yet.
Oh, yeah, I missed that too, and I feel stupid for missing it. But, but I think the northerner people would know.
I mean, it might be an interesting kind of discussion, because like Asha doesn't recognize him at the end, and yet this kind of like random guy does. That does seem a little odd, but perhaps just maybe a convenience of storytelling.
Yeah, okay, I guess it could just be that everyone in Winterfell knows what Theon looks like now.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So if that's everything on the first of the Theon chapters, we then jump forward around 60 pages in my paperback edition of Dance with Dragons, and over four chapters to the first and last Theon chapter that's actually called Theon, which is obviously deeply resonant. So it's either called Theon 1 or 7, depending on how you're counting them. This chapter takes place a day after the last one, on August 6, 300 AL, and it's Michael with the chapter summary.
Winterfell is tense with the knowledge that Stannis is close by. Theon is being trailed by one of the Spearwives now that their plan to rescue Arya has been hatched, though Theon has decided not to tell Aegon that Jaime is not truly Arya. Hos Dean Frey comes inside the Great Hall with the body of Little Walder, who Big Walder says was searching for a White Harbor man. Theon looks at the Spearwives, but they deny their role in the killing of this one. Hostine accuses Wyman Manderly of having this boy killed, to which Wyman responds by insulting both the boy and the Freys. A fight breaks out, with Hostine slashing at Wyman's neck, causing him to collapse to the floor. Roose Bolton manages to break up the fight and informs both Freys and Manderlys that they will go out and do battle with Stannis. The Spearwives tell Theon they must rescue Arya now, before Stannis is attacked. The Spearwives dress up as serving girls and fetch bathwater for Arya. To Theon's shock, the plan works and they enter Ramsay's bedchamber. They find Jaime hiding under piles of furs covered in bite marks. She's scared at first and thinks that this is a trick set up by Ramsay, but Theon reassures her by saying, "My name is Theon and we have come to take you away from him." Jaime switches clothes with Squirrel and they leave unnoticed. Three of them go to fetch Aegon, while Holly and Frenya go with Theon to the gate at the walls. They murder the guards, but Jaime lets out a scream, alerting the garrison. Frenya stays behind to hold off the soldiers, while Theon, Jaime, and Holly climb to the outer wall. Holly belatedly realizes that Frenya had the rope to escape before being shot with a crossbow bolt. With soldiers coming both left and right, Theon realizes there is nowhere else to go and jumps with Jaime out into the snow.
What an amazing chapter.
Yeah, this one's great. This one's, it's got everything. It's got confrontations, it's got fighting, it's obviously Theon coming full circle with him gaining his identity. Like, that's obvious.
Walrus flopping.
Like a clubbed seal.
Like a club. It has two of the best lines, like, of this book, with the clubbed walrus and then the, had he lived, he would have grown up to be a Frey.
That was really interesting. Like, and then Hostine immediately draws a sword and goes in for the kill. Like there's, I guess in Hostine's mind, like the three other Freys are missing, so he probably thinks that Wyman rightly killed them. And yeah, it's just these tensions are just so there that it's ready to snap.
Yikes. You went a little robotic there, Michael.
Oh, okay.
But we got the
message. Okay, cool.
But yeah, no, that's like, as we mentioned with the previous chapter, right? Yeah, it's just the tensions have hit the boiling point where, you know, Roose is just is forced to march out. Otherwise, you know, people like might as well put. So if people are going to die and start fighting each other, might as well just send them towards the enemy instead. So
how
do you think is going to happen to Wyman Manderly? Do you think he's going to survive this?
Yeah, I do. His chin saved him.
Yeah, only three of his four chins were cut. George takes the time to point that out.
Yeah.
I think he'll be all right, but I think it's interesting that Theon is like, you know, he sees a look in Roose Bolton that he's never seen before, you know, like, was it fear? And I think that he let Hosteen, you know, go after White Harbor, knowing that, you know, White Harbor right now was his biggest threat to begin with. And then only after, like, some carnage was done did he call a halt to it.
I feel like he's just losing his hold on things, and things are just erupting that he can't control. But it certainly is in his interests to have Wyman Manderly killed, and not by him specifically.
Yeah, for sure. But like, I think just that one passage where Theon's like, what does that look on his face? Like, throughout the entire books, like, you know, that's how, like, I guess some of the vampire theories or whatever that like, happens. Like, he just has a naturally intimidating, while like soft spoken, but like intimidating look that scares people into submissions. And to see him kind of maybe wide eyed and like scared or not knowing what to do or not knowing how to handle something has to be very off-putting to everyone that's been cowed into a position of subservience from him.
So does anyone have any interesting ideas on who actually killed Little Walder?
Oh, it's Big Walder, right?
Damn it, I was going to say that. You're all going to be surprised.
Yeah, I'm in that camp, too, that like this particular killing is unique and that it was probably just Big Walder trying to cash in on the chaos.
The clue of sorts is that Big Walder has blood on his cloak, hands, and tunic, and none of it has frosted over, whereas Little Walder's frosted in blood, and Hosteen's hands are also caked in ice. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just the fact that, like this killing was, like, actually, like, I think done by a blade or whatever and wasn't kind of, you know, seemingly accidental like the others.
Oh, yeah, the guy that accidentally got his own junk shoved down his throat.
Right, yeah. But, like, it's, yeah. But, yeah, it's, you're right, but it's still, like, kind of the MO just feels a little different.
I do like how Theon equates this to, like, when he was holding Winterfell and his men kept on ending up dead mysteriously. Like, he even says, like, oh, this seems so familiar, except, you know, it was, you know, grim, whatever the fuck his name was, and Red Island or whatever.
So this little Walder, we hear in this chapter, his father was Merit, who you might remember from the epilogue of A Storm of Swords. And I remember in his epilogue POV, he like just kind of feels sorry for himself, and you don't really get an indication of his personality. But from A Feast for Crows, when we get Jaime's recollection, Jaime's like, God, that guy was a dick.
He fucked a girl, got the pox, got hit in the head by a knight or something, and was like unconscious for 2 weeks, right? And that's why he drinks so much, because he has like some kind of migraine issue. Like, his original job at the Red Wedding was to drink Big John
or Great John,
yeah.
But yeah, and Jaime describes him as a bully, and he said, yeah, and then he made the mistake of trying to bully me. So I just thought, okay, I understand why Little Walder's a piece of shit.
Isn't his daughter the Gatehouse Amy, too?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Fat Walder.
Not to slut shame, but she's a little slutty.
Hey, no slut shaming on this thread. She wants to open her gate, that's fine. It's her business.
Three stable boys at a time.
But yeah, so Little Walder's sister, Fat Walder, is married to Roose Bolton. So yeah, Merritt did pretty well. His progeny are going places.
No thanks to him.
Yeah, didn't he even remark, like, in his epilogue chapter that he was proud of the fact that Roose Bolton chose his daughter, and his Walder Frey's like, you idiot, it's only because she was the fattest and I offered her the weight in silver or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just find it interesting. Like, there's certain groups of Freys that George seems to pay a bit of attention to, and so, like, this is one. You have, like, the Rosby phrase, the Blackwood phrase, I think, are also important. There's so many, I really have trouble keeping them apart like everyone else. But, yeah, there are some phrases that are more important than the others.
It's kind of a useful trick George can pull, because the phrases are hard to tell apart. It can be a bit tricky to realize what's happening inside that family, like how there are clearly branches of that family pruning itself in order to be better placed for the succession. Like, obviously, yeah, and I think Big Walder is not the only one bumping off Frey's to get a better claim when Walder Frey dies, the Lord.
Yeah, and I think Merritt goes through that in his epilogue, too. Like, oh, we have to be nice to this guy because he's most likely going to, you know, inherit everything. And if this guy inherits, then we're going to be destitute. And I think Black Walder is just fucking everyone. And, yeah.
Yeah, Black Walder only has one person left that he needs to kill in order to take the head of the house.
Yeah, well, now Lady Stoneheart's doing a lot of his work for him, so that's nice.
Right, I think, but he's been tipping her off.
Really?
Yeah, I think that was the impression I got. To be fair, it's been a while since I've done my research into that.
I thought they were getting tipped off by the singer, Thomas Evans.
Yeah, that too, but I think even before that, because
Black Walder is tracking the Brotherhood, but then he loses them, and I think it's thought he maybe he just like gives up the chase because he's like, yeah, that was good that you killed Peter Pimple, his other brother. I don't know.
That was the first guy hanging when Merritt shows up to the Tree Grove.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, and then they also kill Merritt. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't see Lady Stoneheart giving Black Walder a pass just for, you know, information.
Right, I'm saying he wouldn't be doing it directly, he'd just be leaking information, but that's a little off topic here.
Can we talk about something
this is a really good
chapter. Oh, sorry. Can we talk about something that Stefan Sasse brings up on his blog, which is about how this chapter really nicely shows up the different types of bigotry amongst the people who are in that castle. So you've got the kind of hardcore northerners who look down upon the Freys as being sort of soft southerners who can't cope, who just aren't, you know, war tried and winter tried. And then you've got the attitude towards the wildlings, which is also kind of completely bigoted. And the idea that Theon, in his kind of having been othered as Reek and everything he's gone through, is kind of uniquely placed to observe all of this quite wryly and quite well. And to get nervous when he thinks the wildling girls aren't acting like maids, but in general to sort of really have an overview of what's going on. I mean, he actually is quite an astute observer of all the different currents that are going on at Winterfell, I feel.
Well, I think the northern hostility towards the Freys is all based on the Red Wedding, but I agree that the wildlings just seem so stubborn and proud that they can't act like a fucking washerwoman for 2 seconds, like, to play their part. Like, the fact that they're being like molested, or serving women are molested by like the guards, is a different topic. But I think that the fact that Theon points out, like, oh well, you know, what's her name used to, you know, flirt with this boy just to see what the broth tastes like, or, you know, used to try to get an extra biscuit or something from flirting with this other boy, I think it just shows that their stubbornness, and like the fact that when they really call them kneelers, they really have this independence that, you know, is almost unflappable.
Yeah, their lordly has spoken and now they must obey. I feel bad for the wildling women because, as we know in later chapters, they all die, or will someone die in this chapter. But
or yeah. Do they?
Right. I would think the main thing is, yeah, they very well could be all dead, just because I assume that Aegon has been found out. That seems like, apart from the pink letter, that's probably likely. And yeah, if he's been found out, like, you know, all of them, all of the washerwomen, you know, the wildlings clearly came with him, so they would immediately be suspects. So if they didn't like leave immediately, you know, if they hadn't escaped the castle immediately, they would likely be killed.
Right, but Aegon/Mance is a little fucking rascal. Like, the only reason he's doing this whole guise is to do, like, whatever that bard did way back when. So he's going to hide in the crypts and not be found out. And I don't understand. I don't know.
I've been thinking about what you were talking about, Bina, in regards to, like, the bigotries between the various groups. And it's kind of, it's an obvious point, but it's interesting how there's, like, a spectrum of this bigotry in, like, the free folk of the wildlings look at the northerners the same way the northerners look at the southerners, and the southerners look at the northerners the same way the northerners look at the wildlings, right? Like, to the phrase, all the Northmen are kind of savage, uncivilized, uncouth. Likewise, that's what a lot of people in the North would say about the wildlings. And, you know, Northerners and wildlings would agree that the people from the Riverlands are soft, but people with the wildlings think the Northerners are a little soft too. Like, it's interesting that it's
there's like always someone you can look
bigotry.
Yeah, all the shit flows down or up, whichever way you're looking at it, I guess.
Right. So it's kind of a bizarre thing where, like, you guys are all holding the same prejudices against each other, but it also creates like odd areas of agreement. Like, this couldn't happen because of the nature of the situation, but like a wildling and a Northman could look at a Frey and like scoff and call him soft, right? At the same time, because they are agreed in their prejudice about each other or about the various groups within. And to the point about the Freys, like the Freys, I don't think are purely hated merely for the Red Wedding. They seem to have a pretty unloved reputation at the very start of the books. Though I know some of that was Catelyn's bringing in the history of the Freys through her perspective. But you have to imagine that Northern lords have been dealing with the Freys every single time they want to go south, or many of them have to deal with them. So there's probably been some unpleasantness, and the Krennic men hate the Freys. Like, they have bad blood between them. So there's obviously quite a bit of tension between the Freys especially and Northerners in general.
Maybe the Freys are sort of victims of historical accident, right? Like, the Riverlands are the worst place to be. When you are the Freys, when you're in charge of the crossing, effectively everyone's going to hate you because you hold a pivotal piece of power and can make yourself awkward whenever they want to traverse. So maybe it's no surprise that the Freys are one of the more hated houses, because they'll be known to more people because they are geographically at that sort of very crucial spot. Helped, of course, by their own wheeling and dealing, but maybe some of this is just geographic accident, so to say.
Yeah, the phrase power is entrenched in reality in a way that some other houses, it's more ephemeral. You know, the Aarons are strong because they're the Lord Paramounts of the Vale. But what does that mean in a literal sense? Like, well, they have these strong mountains that protect them. But the phrase, like, cool, you want to go south? Want to deal with this? No? Then you're not going anywhere. And you have to, like, that. There's no sidestepping that as a reality. I also wanted to comment a little bit on the Manderleys. I think the element of when Lord Manderly gets threatened and Theon notes, like, is that fear in his eyes, in Roose Bolton's eyes. The Manderleys are probably the Stark's strongest vassals throughout the story, especially when we get those Davos chapters where, you know, there's freshly built ships. White Harbor is the largest city in the North. Like, the Manderleys are probably a key element to holding down the North successfully for whoever tries to do it. So as much as Roose and the Manderleys don't get along, I think he knows he needs them.
Well, wouldn't they be the biggest threat to him politically, as well as, you know, them supporting anyone who would support the Starks?
Right. Like, the Manderleys can't rule the North because they worship the Seven, and they're always probably going to be seen a little bit as outsiders, but like, they are perfect powers behind the throne for the North, right? Like, that's why I think there's an idea that Manderly was trying to position himself, or is trying to position himself, to be like the regent for Rickon or something like that, because that would be really politically advantageous and would make sense given the politics of the North.
You see, I didn't think that they were viewed as kingmakers. Like, I thought that their loyalty was so ingrained because, you know, they got thrown out of the Mander and the Starks gave them refuge, that no matter what, that they'd be loyal to them.
I think some of that is myth, though. I think a lot is made of, like, oh, this historical loyalty, like, okay, so the Karstarks are an actual branch of the Stark family, and their loyalty has definitely fallen into question. So it's easy to say, yes, hundreds of years ago you saved our family from being kicked out of Westeros, but, you know, what have you done for me lately is a fair analysis to apply to any of these great houses.
What have you done for me lately? Do 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 do. Good Janet Jackson reference there, SGD. Michael, are you back on? Can we hear you? Are you robotic? I think you have an interesting marriage prediction to make to the group.
And he'll be championing Rickon as, you know, the Stark to inherit, And I think just as an added bonus, he's going to say, oh, and Rickon, I've got my nice daughter here. You know, you're of a similar age. It just, that's the kind of self-serving loyalty that I see in Wyman. There's nothing wrong with that.
No, because loyalty deserves reward, and that marriage would be the reward for bringing Rickon back to his seat of power, right?
And sticking his neck out at this time, you know, when it was dangerous.
His four necks out.
Well, now it's just one.
There's something kind of interesting about this chapter in that, like, one of Theon's great sins is killing the Miller's boys in spot of Bran and Rickon. And ironically, he's redeeming himself by saving another person who is not a Stark. So, like, there's this weird parallelism between impersonators of Starks and Theon's relationship to them. It's weird that's a great like the source of his redemption.
Yeah, that's a really nice symmetry. Anything else on the chapter, folks?
Ramsay Bolton is scary.
Yes. Yes. When you see Jane with teeth marks on her tit, I mean, it's just horrific. The sexual abuse that she and then complicitly Theon have been through. It's just another reminder of how horrid it is.
Mm-hmm. Do you think George went too far with Ramsay Bolton?
Ugh, I don't know.
It's actually interesting how out of focus Ramsay is in these chapters.
So, what is Ramsay making her do with the dogs?
That's a question I really don't want an answer to, Matt.
Yeah. It's fair.
Yeah. Bia's question is a tough one to answer. It's probably can only be answered on an individual basis.
Yeah, and I think that Euron is also on track to maybe outdo Ramsay, depending on what he does in Winds. But from the preview chapters, it seems like he is not a nice fellow.
Yeah, I mean, like, for me, I feel like enough is kept off screen that, like, it didn't go too far for me personally, but I don't know. I certainly can't speak for everyone.
I think it goes pretty far, and perhaps excessively far in that dimension. Like, he becomes so monstrous that, you know, there's no question. You know, a lot of characters who are the antagonists or arguably the antagonists in the series have at least some moral ambiguity, or that their evil deeds come from some place of self-interest or self-promotion or what have you. Like Black Walder might be helping bump off his family members, but his ultimate goal is probably security and power, right? Like, he's not just like, I sure do love slaughtering members like of my own family. Yeah. So I don't know if it's a little too easy to make Ramsay like the child of rape is a monster and all this other, like, he's really twisted in a horrific way.
I mean, what I find problematic about it is the idea that somehow the child of rape, and I know that there is a sense in which people who are abused are more likely to abuse, and that is a real thing, but somehow, I don't know, you don't want it to be sort of backward induced that it will make you monstrous if you happen to be the victim of rape or your mother having been raped. So that makes me always a little bit uneasy. But then part of me thinks this is a world that is so large and so rich. And we know that there are people like this in the world. There are just serial killers who are just sadistic and evil and do brutally horrible, evil, sadistic things to women. Or men, actually, some of them. So is it unrealistic to have one sadistic, brutal, almost serial killer type personality in the books? No. And it is interesting that George does often leave some of it off screen. He seems to have found his limit. Is it where I would have put the limit? Maybe not. But I don't mind his inclusion. And I don't mind the idea that sometimes people are made evil by circumstance, but then sometimes some people are just evil. I don't mind that being in this world.
I suppose I would say, like, Ramsay is not one. I mean, Joffrey, there's evidence that Joffrey was one. There's evidence maybe that Gregor Clegane is another, that Euron Greyjoy is another, that, like, all of his characters might be... his big baddies especially might be this way. So I don't know. And Ramsay, I think, might be the pinnacle of this type.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. Like, there is, I mean, yeah, there's whole essays on George's attitude towards sexual violence, right, and where it's problematic. Okay, so Michael is making a point. Sadly, he's gone very robotic, listeners, so he's typed it out about the idea that he thought there might be a Rickon and Willa marriage in the future, and but then the idea of loyalty being self-serving. George keeps Ramsay, and then onto the sadism, he says, George keeps Ramsay out of focus in many of these chapters, so we don't see the horrors. They are implied. The chapter ends with Theon bending to his task, but doesn't detail it. So I guess Michael's point is there is a sense in which George does have the sensitivity to hold him at bay. Like, even George doesn't want to quite take us truly into the mind and the actions of Ramsay in the way that sometimes he does with Joffrey, I guess. Thoughts on that?
I mean, sure, but we get a kind of secondhand through Theon, who was on the receiving end of a lot of Ramsay's torture, that we know exactly what he's doing. So I don't know if he is that blurry. Like, maybe the horrors with Jane are mostly implied, but like I said, when she's like, I'll do it, whatever with the dogs, and it's like, what the fuck was she doing? Like, what did he want to see done? What's going on? She's like, oh, don't chop off my feet, I won't run. I'm like, what is, you know, that's weird bed talk for them.
Yeah, I'm probably enough on that, but what annoys me the most about Ramsay as a character is just how it seems too easy for him to get away with what he does, and that's probably the part that gets to me the most.
Right, it's like comically awful, like comically evil, like somehow he's some evil genius that gets away with everything.
Yeah, but then couldn't you say the same of Euron?
Euron has actual, like, I feel Euron has, like, actual, like, skills and, like, intelligence.
He went to Valyria. Like, he's done some shit in his life. He's lived his life.
Ramsay's
just been a little shithead forever.
Right, yeah, that's, like, the mix of it, where, like, he gets away with this stuff so easily, but like, I'm blanking on, like, what word I'm looking for, but, like, he just doesn't have the natural, like, presence and gravitas that it kind of, like, takes to be, like, I don't know, like, a like an evil, like, mastermind or leader of a cartel or something along those lines, where he's you know, this little, like, shit who really doesn't have much skill in combat or anything, and yet, like, people just, like, allow this to happen when any number of people could easily just kill him.
Yeah, I see that. And he just causes his father so much trouble. You can't understand why. I mean, I guess his father's desperate for an heir, but still. I mean, yeah, that's always seemed like a bit implausible to me, that Rhys just lets him wander around getting away with all this shit. Anything else on these chapters? Okay, then let's move on to the final chapter today. So after the Theon chapter, we jump over 10 chapters and 150 pages in my edition of A Dance with Dragons to The Sacrifice, or Asha 2. It's a long chapter, and actually, if you look at the Redditor's ordering of these chapters, he starts it. He would have had Asha 2 first, but I think with what happens at its culmination, it makes sense to put it here. It's a long chapter. It culminates 3 days after Theon's escape on August 9th, 300 AL, and I believe it's Vali with the chapter summary.
Yeah, so Stannis' army is doing real well. They're so hungry that they're starting to eat their own dead. When four men are found to do that, they're burnt at the stake as a sacrifice to Red Relu, as Big Bucket Wall refers to him, which is why I love him. So they're really in dire straits here. The king hasn't been seen except for the sacrifice. He's been watching a beacon fire in his tower that he's been hanging out with, and a lot of people are talking about what's next. They talk about, you know, well, should we storm Winterfell and then they die? Should we build siege ladders? And yeah, sure, but then we die. And all along, Asha's just thinking, these men are, you know, kind of struggling between a king, a god, and the elements. Asha has also been kind of predated upon by Suggs, Sir Clayton Suggs, who is almost the worst. He seems to enjoy torturing people, especially young women, setting them on fire. But at the end of the chapter, when he hears horses and thinks it might be the enemy coming, he says, well, he does call her the C word again for like the fourth time in the chapter. But tell him to go tell the king that the enemy is here and I'll hold them off, which is kind of brave, which I thought was interesting considering how despicable he's made throughout the entire chapter. And those people on horses end up being Iron Islanders that were ransomed by the Iron Bank of Braavos, Tycho Nestoris, and among them was Theon. And even though that Asha did not know him by sight, he said, "I'm Theon. You have to know your name," to kind of play on their first meeting in Clash of Kings.
You know, I like kind of the point we brought up at the end of the Ghost of Winterfell, with kind of the unknown drums sounding outside, where there's such, you know, fear and murmurings amongst the castle that Stannis is here. And then we get the same thing at the end of this, like, oh shit, like Roos has already ridden upon us, you know, prepare everyone, as we kind of get the horses coming up in the end. So yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of good bits with a literal fog of war here, in this case, like snows of war. That's very fascinating. And there's a lot of little like details here, and George setting up the geography of this village with the two lakes and the watchtower, that kind of come into a lot of the theorizing that's been done about the upcoming Battle of Winter. And I'm particularly a fan of those types of things in these novels.
Yeah, so he describes that they're running out of food, and one of the northerners, I think it's a Flint, says, oh, you've overfished them. You've been on the lake like maggots. Like, you've cut so many holes into it. And like you said, it describes the watchtower between two lakes. So they're really setting up this, like, Alexander Nevsky kind of battle plan where, you know, they're expecting the Bolton force to ride up over these pockmarked lakes and fall through, and therefore, you know, not have to fight that force, but have to fight the main force coming up through the land bridge.
My only comment in this chapter was rather trivial, which is that it's only been 3 days' journey from Winterfell, and Jane has apparently already lost her nose to frostbite, which seemed rather frightening.
Well, I mean, the bodies were frozen overnight, and the pools in the Godwood weren't even frozen. So I don't understand how things work in Winterfell.
I was just saying the pools in Winterfell are fed by a hot spring, so they're not going to freeze very easily. But
No, but like in Clash of Kings, they talk about like going through the mud, even though they're north of the wall and it's freezing out and they're all shivering cold. Like, yeah, I don't think it's...
I think you're right that there's inconsistency in the weather in general with the story a little bit.
Like, you could probably stand to watch for eight hours, like, in 30 degrees. It'll suck, but it won't freeze you if you have the right clothing, but...
Yeah, the right clothing is the big asterisk on there, because I don't remember the numbers anymore, but, like, you can freeze to death at comparatively low temperatures, because most time when people are outside at low temperatures, it's for brief windows of time. But if you are spending hours and hours and hours, like, it's also just physically exhausting. They're losing a lot of energy. Their body's trying to replenish their heat and keeping themselves going. So I in general, in this chapter, I really liked the oppressive, malicious force of nature in this section, that the inescapable grip of late autumn, not even winter yet, just makes everything incredibly untenable. Like, these two sides are falling apart based more on the conditions than anything the other could do, than their enemy could do to them.
Well, it goes to what we were just talking about northerners judging southerners in, like, the winter, and they're like, this isn't that bad, man. Like, you gotta get over it.
Yeah. I did feel when I was reading this, it reminded me of reading stuff about the Second World War and the First World War about the Eastern Front, of just like how crippling the environment could be and devastating it could be, but there was still this push, like, you know, you either go forward or die, or you surrender or die, or eventually if you do nothing, the environment will get you anyway. So I wondered if George was tapping into some of those feelings.
Yeah. Or similarly, you can make an analogy to the Napoleonic Wars and just being defeated by the Russian winter.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely like the I can't remember the name of the artist, but the picture of the French soldiers retreating, and they're all like ragged, and Napoleon lost, I think, 100,000 men in the Russian campaign and to the weather, essentially. A lot of that comes to mind when I think about Stannis's and the Bolton's winter fight.
I guess when people are resorting to cannibalism, which I think they did in like Stalingrad at least, and maybe in the Napoleonic invasion of Russia. But at what point are they like, okay, no, this has gone too far. We can't actually feed our people like bread fried in grease and be like, that's good enough for them.
I don't know. I mean, it's like, I mean, both sides have kind of just, you know, hit a point where they pretty much just like have to fight now. I mean, you know, Stannis has been through this before with the siege. And so, you know, even though he's like, he's terrible in terms of charisma and keeping his people together, like he's also just kind of stubborn and like he's going to be the one to wait longer. And in order to force Roos to come
yeah,
at
he's
him.
The one on the move. Like, he's the attacker.
Right, right. But he had to be on the move to, like, get there. But, like, at this point, his people have no chance of actually, like, you know, I don't know, like, sieging or scaling, like, some wall, you know, without some sort of, like, Theon-esque trickery. Like, he kind of just has to be the one to fight with them in more of an open space before he has a chance of even like taking Winterfell.
I was curious if anyone had any thoughts on Stannis's state of mind in this chapter, cloistering himself away in the tower, the way he appears when they execute the men, like where his head's at the moment. Cause I was trying to map it out a little bit, but I was struggling to think like, how is Stannis doing and what is his process right now?
I don't think it's good. And I think it will change when Theon is actually brought to him and he learns the situation at Winterfell. Otherwise, I think he thinks that Melisandre's left him, has left him to die, there's no help coming, and I think it's a thing of despair for him.
Yeah, no, it's obviously really hard to know just because we don't get, like, there's not a POV there to provide us any particular insight. But I just, I mean, I think we're just going to see a growing trend here over the course of Stannis' storyline of his kind of like mental space, you know, slowly breaking down and him becoming more desperate, you know, to try and kind of like win the day here. And I don't think this part in the story is his breaking point, but I imagine we'll see it relatively soon. And so I just think we're going to kind of see a downward spiral and to see how he ends up, like, which way he breaks in the end.
To me, it feels like when he's at the wall, there's a certain tension, but there's also a confidence he has. Like, maybe it's just they're coming off the high of defeating the wildlings. And, like, he's at the wall, he's performing as king. You know, he is exercising his duties and authority beyond just whatever army is immediately around him. And then I wonder, stalling on this campaign, like, is Stannis becoming a defeatist for his own cause? Like, does he believe he's ultimately going to win? Or is he just, like, playing out the last act of his destiny according to his own thinking?
It's hard to know how much he believes his own hype, but does he believe everything Melisandre has told him about himself? And therefore, how far of a psychic shock is it going to be when she abandons him, if and when she does so? And I just don't really feel I have a hold on what Stannis' inner motivation is. Is it that he clings on to this very simple thing that Robert was my brother, I'm the next in line? Or does he kind of buy into this logic that he is some mythic leader? I don't know. I really feel I don't know him.
I think he really thinks that, like, he's the next in line because Robert's sons were all bastards. And it's his right, not his, you know, desire or privilege. It's his right to be king. And to do that, he's now doing the offenses that he's doing.
So that hasn't changed since the start, though. So you think he basically is the same guy he was 5 books ago, steadfast.
I think he's smart enough to know that he does not have a flaming sword, and he's not, you know, Azor Ahai come again. I think he's very confident that that propaganda will help him with what he knows is rightfully his.
Yeah, and I think he's you know, fully committed in his, you know, what he believes is his duty to become the next king. But yeah, but at the same time, he is kind of relatively defeatist, just because, you know, he's been, you know, he's never really been given any reward for whatever his successes have been throughout his life. And so, yeah, I think maybe in the back of his mind, he doesn't fully expect to succeed, but it really doesn't matter. He's going to commit to it anyway.
Yeah, regarding where Stannis' mental state is, I think he's sort of got this grim determination now. Just he has to see things through. Yeah, but that doesn't add much.
Yeah, I think if ever there were a phrase to describe Stannis, it would be grimly determined. Do you all think we're going to get a Stannis POV in the next book? Do we know this? Has anything been hinted about it?
Generally, I think the rule of thumb is that when George was writing the series, the idea is none of the kings would be POV characters. So if he continues with that, that Stannis will never receive a POV. And I think he doesn't have to have a POV. He's got lots of characters floating around him.
Yeah, I'm still trusting the fact that there will be no new POVs with the exception of prologues and epilogues. So, like, it would have to be one of those. And I don't, like, there's no way. Well, I mean, I guess technically it could still be a prologue, but I don't think so. Like, I think if we ever got one, it would be as an epilogue, but I don't know. It doesn't seem like it would happen. I think he's
If we get one, it's bad news for Team Stannis.
Right, yeah. My view of Stannis and my interest in his character has always been to see what his fall is going to be like. And I think I would rather see it from an outside perspective.
I wouldn't mind a Stannis, maybe prologue or epilogue, just to truly get under his skin. But yeah, no, I don't think he's so dour. I'm not sure I could cope reading many chapters of his.
Yeah.
I do wonder how much time he has left.
Well, he has about another year.
Yeah, he's definitely one of the ones that I feel like could be gone by the end of Winds.
Oh, I was just saying that Winds would be out maybe in another year or right. Get more news.
Yeah, no.
I was like, how are you going to measure a year? Is that like six books based on George's progress?
974,600 minutes.
That's actually not a bad point, Michael. Yeah, with the Slayer of Lies, unless that's only going to apply to Fagon. I don't remember the exact wording of the prophecy on that one.
It was a tall man who cast no shadow is one of the prophecies. Yeah.
Right, because like she definitely will bring down the Mummer's dragon, but
it's just that doesn't mean Dany has to take Stannis out. And any of this is unclear for anyone listening. We're talking about the House of the Undying prophecies. That doesn't mean Dany has to take him out, because she could just prove that he is not Azor Ahai, which if she is Azor Ahai, then she displaces him as the candidate. Or, you know, if he dies on a battlefield outside of Winterfell, then he is obviously not Azor Ahai.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like even Jon could be the one to do that.
Right.
Well, Jon's dead.
Anything else on the chapter?
How did Tycho Nestorius and everyone move around the North so quickly?
Oh, he's a fucking faceless man. that's what was one I feels like that in my bones. Like, it's crazy. Like, the way he's been able to maneuver, like, it feels like only someone with faceless man-esque skills could do that.
I did want to comment on just how horrifying the Red God's religion is. Like, burning to death is one of the worst ways to die. At least that's what I've heard. So just, like, people reveling in
that. Who do you know
that
burned to death?
I don't know. I wasn't there for the autopsy, Matt. I'm just, you know, I read lines about their pubic hairs singeing off, so. That's in this chapter. Like the Red God is scary as hell, and I think this is one of those elements. I think it definitely adds that flavor, especially also with the character of Suggs, of like your good guys aren't very good, or you know, if you're on Team Stannis, you got to wrestle with a lot of baggage, a lot of darkness in this group as well.
I mean, I also imagine that like when it's gonna come down to trying to beat the others, I feel like a lot of our protagonists are gonna have to grapple with some particularly tough calls.
Why?
I mean, we have no idea what it's gonna take to win at the end of the day, and I mean there's a combination of like the seriousness, you know, what kind of brought the existence of this like religion into being, but you know, and some of it is certainly just normal religious extremism, but I imagine some of it's also probably connected to the last time the others were beaten back. And so I imagine the kind of the myths and the extreme measures that were taken in the past were might repeat themselves again here.
I was going to say that arguably the war against the others should be a fairly moral war, because all human lives are valuable. You need to protect the maximum number of people to save them. But then on the other hand, if you destroy human lives before the others get to them, then they are removed as possible soldiers for the army of whites, which could lead to some horrific decisions by some of the players in that conflict.
I don't know. I think with the battles of ice and fire that are occurring now, that a lot of the fighting people are going to be culled, and we're going to actually hit an opposite direction when the others come.
Right, but I also imagine there will be, at the start of it, I imagine there will be too few. And so, and it seems like in order to make the stakes high enough, there will be some significant losses in the beginning before a final stand can be made and kind of more bodies brought to bear.
Yeah, I agree with that. I love Michael's comment. Stannis needs to grapple with the horrible reality that he's not the protagonist.
Yeah.
It must be horrific, right? He's lived his life as the second son, well, not the second son, but the person who didn't become king. And yeah, his life is just one horrific disappointment to himself and arguably to the rest of us.
Yeah.
We aren't huge Stannis fans.
Yeah, no, it's definitely going to be a tragedy of Shakespearean proportions.
How do you guys feel? I mean, this is where we leave Winterfell, right? We've got some TWOW chapters coming up. And then we've got some John at the wall and a little bit more Danny. But this is it for Winterfell. How do you feel about the idea that this is how George chose to left it, or where his editors, perchance, chose for him to leave it?
Right. It wasn't his ideal. But yeah, I mean, I've definitely spoken about that, you know, on previous casts where, you know, essentially just like the intended climaxes of kind of the second act were pushed back to the detriment of the story. But I mean, there were some that were still left in. Obviously, he made sure to bring up John's death. I mean, he didn't bring it up timeline wise, but you know, he kind of like pushed some of the chapters that are earlier in a timeline back in order to include John's death in the story. So like in terms of the battle, it's disappointing, you know, having to wait on that. But I think in terms of Theon's arc, it was a good ending point.
I think compared to so obviously the two big things missing at the end of this book are the Battle of Ice and the Battle of Fire. I think the absence of the Battle of Ice hurts this less. I wonder if you had that Theon preview chapter from TWOW, if that wouldn't be a more satisfying conclusion because of like that weird, you know, the mystical moment right at the close of that preview chapter. That's a pretty cool moment, and it would, I think, be an interesting note to end on, especially for like Theon's story. But I don't think you need the Battle of Ice so much in this one compared to the kind of the Meereenees mess.
Well, yeah, I think the whole Essos meandering for an entire book thing needed a conclusion where this ended. I think without the preview chapter, I think it ended okay, like with Theon being like, hey, you have to remember your name, and you know, tying that in. And, like, we'll see the battle and the conclusion of this in the next book. But I feel like Essos was so fucking world-building and slow and then a very slow build up to no conclusion at all.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point where it it just to us it feels like that the Northern storyline is moving at a better pace, at a decent pace, where kind of the end point here doesn't hurt as much, where the Myrinese Knot just feels like such a slog that our perspective on it is that he just needs to get it over with, whereas this just feels like it's moving at a more appropriate pace.
It will be interesting if the Boltons actually win this battle, because then we'll have no POV in the northern area at all.
Yeah, there's no way they win. There's no way they win.
Oh, yeah, I guess Melisandre, but she's up there.
I mean, I think story-wise, it makes sense that the Boltons will lose the coming conflict, but I think if you just kind of look at the situation on the ground, if you had to take odds, not story odds, but if you had to measure these two forces, it's interesting because at the beginning, the first Theon chapter we did today, there's a reference to, I think he's eating stew and fresh baked bread, while Asha is like eating horse meat. Like the two armies are not are suffering indeed, but I think the levels are a bit off. It seems like Stannis's forces are definitely at a disadvantage, unless some cool trick comes into play.
Michael says, well, Boltons are going down. Asha has to be queen of the Iron Islands. She ain't dying.
Well, I mean, the big reveal is going to be, when they bring their horses over the cracked up ice, right? And they fall through. And that'll be their big race.
Sure.
Yeah.
But also, the two sides each have a faction in it that's supposed to betray the each other. How does that come off? Does that just create a bunch of confusion? Who nets out the most advantage out of that? No plan survives contact with the enemy. So, yes, the lake is Swiss cheese, and it would be very dangerous to march an army onto it. So who says that's what's going to happen? I don't know.
But how will we know what's happening inside Winterfell, I guess, if there isn't this great big battle?
Yeah. I mean, we've had long stretches of time where we didn't know much of what was going on in Winterfell.
That is fair.
Yeah, I agree with your reasoning. Yeah, my argument is purely from a narrative standpoint.
Yeah, I think it's okay where this leaves off. And I think that's partially because the North feels like it's in a tense stalemate. Like tension is building, while on the other side of the world in Essos, it feels like, no, things are already happening. You just have to draw it to a conclusion. And I think that's possibly why I'm more comfortable with the way this section ends.
But either way, like when you think about what Winds has to cover, these two great battles in the beginning, and then plus everything that's going on in King's Landing, plus Euron, plus Victorian's kind of Battle of Fire, plus Dorne and everything that's going, like where do you find the time?
Yes, we are not, wherever Winds ends, we are not going to be happy with it. That's pretty much guaranteed, but we know at least some stuff is going to be resolved. And Michael brought up a point kind of referencing the Stannis' line of, you may hear that I'm dead. That will probably come into play in this battle as well.
So what do you think, what is the theory about that? That he's going to fake his own death somehow?
Yeah, or just, it'll get, right, the fog of information will somehow have that spread around.
Could be a plot to get Winterfell to open the gates to their forces.
Yes, something that's like what, that. Yeah, that's what
like Michael the Manderleys are at the head of the column, and they're like, we won! The gates open up. It's like, you're screwed.
Michael just said send one of the Karstark ravens in. That is one thing they have, where with Tycho revealing that the Karstarks are a traitor and the Boltons will still believe the Karstarks are on their side.
The Karstarks are totally fucked. Stannis.
Yes, they are. But I mean, they still have an heir, so they'll be fine in the long run.
Yeah, so all right. So Dance with Dragons had 72 chapters, including the prologue and the epilogue. And we still didn't get to the battles that we needed to. So, if Winds of Winter comes out, like, I think I said this before on a previous cast, like, we'll probably get the battles, like, 16, 20 chapters into the books, because they're trying to deal with everything that's happening everywhere else beforehand.
And then the question is, how many chapters will the battles themselves encompass?
You could actually end up with the Winds of Winter still ending with the Battles of Ice and Fire.
I would hate that so much.
But you could imagine a kind of Clash of Kings-style length book ending with the Battles of Ice and Fire, with all the proper build-up, all the proper battle, maybe a bit of like immediate aftermath, but that they are it is the books of the Battles of Ice and Fire.
Right, so you're just saying like your beginning of this entire podcast where we're talking about the slowdown will be like, and in Winds of Winter, there are 80 chapters that took place in a week and a half.
I mean, sure, that's a really pessimistic look at it. I feel like that was the goal with Dance itself. So I'm still, I don't know.
I don't know if it's pessimistic. I'm not saying it won't be a fun read. I'm not sure. I'm not saying it won't be really fantastic. I'm just saying that could be where we are.
Right, but if he does that, I mean, that completely cuts out the possibility of finishing in 7 books, which I don't have high hopes for in general, but I feel like he at least wants to try.
If he wanted to try, he'd release the 6th book by now.
Nah, that's not fair.
To me, it's not fair to me. He's getting to do all the fucking things he wants to do. All I want is the fucking end of the story.
I'm still of the opinion that it'll happen within the first, 200 to 300 pages. We'll have like the battles.
I do wonder then, what's the rest of the 800 pages or whatever follows? Like, because if it's like 200 pages of getting to the battles and then the battles, it's like, okay, you've kind of blown your traditional story arc in that.
Right.
Way. Like, think of Clash of Kings, right? Clash of Kings all builds to the Battle of Blackwater, mm-hmm. and then the aftermath.
Well, it's going to be the invasion of the White Walkers, right? After all the human battles are done, we have to do this supernatural battle.
Yeah, but like the thing is, I suppose it could be that things slow down in Meereen and the North around Winterfell, but things speed up elsewhere. Like Aegon's invasion seems to be moving quickly and effectively. So like the situation in the South could radically change in the space it takes just for like something to unfold elsewhere in the story. That's relatively simple, if you see my point.
Yeah, no, I think the answer to your question is what happens after those two battles. Like the next big thing to come into the fore is Aegon's invasion and how King's Landing responds to that.
It could be a cool parallel if you have 3 chapters in succession of Stannis takes Winterfell, Dany retakes Meereen and decimates the slavers, and Aegon marches into King's Landing to adoring crowds throwing rose petals, right? Like, that'd be a neat, here you go, here are your factions all lining up.
Yeah, no, I do expect kind of Aegon to attack or capture or whatever King's Landing. That seems something that's likely to happen towards the end of the book. Because like, we always talk about the battles of Ice and Fire, but there's more set up here where, we also have to deal with Aegon taking Storm's End. There's the huge naval battle that's about to happen near Old Town. We have, Euron's invasion after that. And then, even after the Battle of Fire, Dany will have to contend with the Dothraki first before she sails,
And what happens with Jaime and Brienne?
Yeah, that too. Like,
we probably actually have 4 big battles coming up, but Ice and Fire has taken the most note. Like you say, the Sea of Blood battle has been hinted at a lot, that Euron is going to do something near Old Town that might like destroy the Red Wine fleet or the High Towers fleet or what have you. And then there very much could be the toppling of the Lions, and Aegon could throw down the Lannisters in King's Landing, and that would be the end of them, because they're basically at the end of their rope. I think it could be the show has distorted people's perspective of how much strength the Lannisters have left.
Well, Kevin's dead, And Cersei sits to stand trial still. So we still have the trial of the two queens in King's Landing and see how that shakes out. And then how that shakes out will determine how Mace Tyrell deploys his forces.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it might, that the conclusion to that might be more of a negotiation than like an actual battle, especially if Aegon is able to is able to bring the faith onto his side.
I'm very curious about that. Sure, it was to cut the whiskey.
No, to cut my phlegm.
Delicious, tasty. I'm a fan of the Aegon arc. I think it's going to go much further than people think it is for a couple of historical and story-based reasons.
In what way? And particularly the story-based ones I'm really interested in.
I think the story-based ones is that Aegon's storyline arguably goes back to the first book. Maybe it's not what George had planned for what Varys and Illyrio are talking about in the crypts, but this was a thread from very early on. I also think it feeds very nicely into, you know, what is this story about? Like, it's not about, you know, Tommen and Joffrey are not Baratheons, they're Lannisters, but, you know, what is the polite fiction we agree to? And even if Aegon is not a Targaryen, it doesn't matter if people believe it. And I think it also justifies all the interest in the Blackfyres, if he is from the Blackfyre line. Like, why did George spend all this time and all this energy exploring the Blackfyres and fake Targaryens and bloodlines to not pay that off in some fashion? And then there's the historical answer of the War of the Roses and how Aegon kind of fits nicely into the Tudors seizing the throne at the conclusion of the War of the Roses.
Ooh, do we think Arnoth Karstark is like a Richard III person that's so crippled and deformed? I know Bina has opinions.
I think the comparison is more just for the description of his character than his role in the story.
You don't think it's like a mirror to Shakespearean Richard III where they made him so crippled to, you know, show him as the bad guy?
I wonder if that's not just partially, you know, he's obviously not very physically fit, so that's why he didn't go off to war with the rest of the family, why he stayed behind, why he's the castellan, that kind of stuff. Though obviously there's a rich narrative tradition of like twisted men, right?
True.
Is that pretty much everything everyone wants to say?
I feel good.
Okay. Well, that's all that matters.
Yep.
I just feel sorry that...
I've made my time.
I just feel sorry that we didn't get to hear more directly from Michael, because normally he has great audio. So hopefully, Michael, you sort it out for the next one, because that was sad. Okay, so that was, as I said before, the last chapters at Winterfell in Dance with Dragons, which is phenomenal. For those reading along at home, the next episode of the reread is going to cover the final T-Wow spoiler chapters. So Theon 1, Mercy and Elaine 1. We didn't actually know where to put these because they're not in the Redditor's timeline, so we've put them all together in one episode. And then following that, it's basically all John and Danny all of the time. You can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress by searching for Vassals of Kingsgrave or VOK Podcast. And if you want to get involved, search for A Podcast of Ice and Fire and join the forums. So with that, thank you so much to the two Matts, to Michael, to Stephen after a long hiatus for joining me. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Peter.
Thanks, Peter.
And do any of you have any VOK episodes forthcoming that you would like to drum up some publicity for?
We're recording a Harry Potter reread in a couple weeks, I think.
It's nice. That feels like it's really got momentum again, which is really cool.
Yeah, once the show stopped, it felt like there was room to breathe and start to record and post stuff.
Indeedy.
Yeah, it's not forthcoming, but me and Sarah and Thomas did Birds of Prey, which was a fun short discussion.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, I think that's pretty much it then. Thanks all for joining and have a great rest of the week, guys. Bye.
See ya.
Bye, guys. 974,600 minutes.
Great analogy to what's going on with coronavirus today, with complete paranoia ahead of all facts and reason.
Well, luckily in the US, we're going to pray it away.
Oh, but your president said it was a hoax, so it's all okay.
One of the best fucking memes, sorry to get off topic, one of the best fucking memes I've ever seen was a screenshot of The Matrix when Neo stops all the bullets with his mind, and it just said, finally, when the thoughts and prayers finally kick in. But we digress. 974,600 minutes. Oh, so one thing I forgot to mention was Arnulf Karstark is hobbling around with him now, and he's brought a maester with ravens. And now, if we could do a spoiler for the Theon Wins a Winter chapter.
I think we can. I think we will edit this, or I will edit this, and we will put this particular comment in the aftershow. Proceed.
So here's my theory. Arnulf Karstark actually wrote the pink letter right before Theon got there, and Arnulf was found out as a traitor.
How would he know about Mance?
Because Stannis knows.
Right, but Stannis freely gave that information to Karstark?
I mean, after a certain time, you tell your, you know, allies, like, when everyone's, you know, saying that, oh, we'll build siege towers and we'll die, we'll build ladders and we'll die, let them talk like that while the leaders are being like, well, I have a guy inside that will open up the doors for us.
I guess, yeah, I guess the main thing is, was that ever part of Mance's goals? He was asking about the crypts and how Theon took the castle. All right, so yeah, even though they never really discussed it, that certainly could have been part of his overall goals.
So the only thing that would throw that off, obviously, is this timeline and whether or not in a couple of days we see the pink letter reach, or, you know, a week. We see the pink letter reach Jon Snow.
Yeah, I mean, that was, like, right, we looked at, right before this episode, sorry, yeah, we looked at the timeline for that, where that chapter is listed kind of at the very end of the timeline, but there were, I think the Redditor kind of made a specific, like, he seemed pretty uncertain as to the exact dating for that chapter.
So that's my new theory. Karstark wrote the pink letter.
I don't buy it, but not bad.
But why don't you buy it? Because the timeline doesn't work, or you don't see the sort of the narrative point?
No, I still don't see Stannis revealing Mance to Karstark. I don't know. And he doesn't feel like a big enough character where I feel like it has to be like Ramsay Roose or Stannis himself.
But still one of his allies. Like, why wouldn't, you know, they're in dire straits. Like, why wouldn't they say, like, at this point, I have a person inside the walls of Winterfell?
Right, yeah. I mean, like, I don't know. It doesn't... Yeah, I got nothing beyond that, just because I don't exactly remember when Karstark kind of pulled up. I know he's relatively new. You know, it seems like a relative newcomer to the situation. And it just doesn't feel like enough time has passed for Mance to bring him in on everything.
Stannis.
Sorry, yeah, you're right.
Michael, do you have any points that you want to say? Do you want to try the microphone and see if it works? Maybe it's cleared. Michael says pink letter is Ramsay's work. Sorry, Matt. Michael, why don't you try the microphone and see if it works again?
Oh, guys, I'm scared I'll be more of a robot if I come back on.
No, it's good. It's good. Carry on quickly while it works.
So far, so good.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, God. Yeah. Ramsay wrote the pink letter. I don't think there was ever meant to be a mystery behind who wrote it. It reads exactly as, like, something Ramsay would say.
You came back for that? Really? 974,600 minutes.